2 Timothy chapter 3, we're going to pick up in our reading at verse 1. I'll be reading from the New King James Version. Begin our comments about verse 5. We may have gone over verse 5 last Lord's Day morning, but we'll pick up there for the sake of context. In 2 Timothy 3, beginning in verse 1, Paul writes to the young evangelist, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away." In this context, Paul is describing false teachers, as we're going to see in just a moment, and especially even with this verse that we ended with in verse 5. These individuals whom he has in mind have a form of godliness, that is, a semblance of godliness. They show by their actions that they seem to be pious, that they seem to be religious, that they seem to be devoted to God. But in all actuality, it's just a smokescreen. They're hypocrites. They are indeed religious people, as we'll see in the context, because they have a form of godliness, so they pretend to be godly, but they're not. Godliness is reverence, respect, piety, devotion toward God. So they put on a show, often referred to in the New Testament as hypocrites. Jesus condemned the religious leaders of his day for that very thing. And so the general characteristics of people during this particular period of time that was religious, especially those who held to the law of Moses as a means of justification or salvation, they were big pretenders of being righteous before God when in fact they were not. So having a form of godliness but denying its power, that is, they denied the power of godliness. To deny the power of godliness is to reject the power of godliness, reject or renounce godliness, that is, reject or renounce devotion toward God, reject or renounce reverence toward God, not have any respect for God. So they deny its power. There is power in godly living. There is power in being able to live a life that shows respect and reverence for God. But they deny it. They reject it. And how do they do that? Well, with their conduct. And of course, he says at the end of verse 5, from such people turn away. From such people turn away. That is, avoid them, shun them, have nothing to do with them. So that's what Timothy is to do. These people, even though it's said in chapter 3 and verse 1, know this, that in the last days, Timothy was living in the last days. He was living in the last days, and these people were present. If not, Timothy could not turn away from them. He could not shun them. He could not have nothing to do with them. But it describes people of such character that lives in every age. Just as there were false teachers in this particular age that Timothy needed to shun, to turn away from, and this is not something that he had just mentioned in this particular epistle. Remember, in regard to those who would make up a great house back in chapter 2, nevertheless, in verse 19, "Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity." Depart from iniquity. But in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold or silver, but also wood and clay, some for honor and some for dishonor. Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from the latter, the vessels of dishonor in the context, of course, were such men as Hymenaeus and Philetus, mentioned back in verse 17. So though it seems the context has changed in chapter 3 and in verse 1 and following, it really hasn't. He's been talking about false teachers, as he talked about in his first epistle. And of course, we're to have nothing to do with them. We're to shun them. We're to stay away from them, because they'll bring ruin, condemnation to our souls. They just simply are hypocrites. Verse 6, For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Now as Jannes, I think is the correct pronunciation, Jannes, as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, so did these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapprove concerning the faith, but they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all, as theirs also was. So back in verse 6, for of this sort, of this kind, that is, these kind of men that have been mentioned in verse 1 through verse 5, these kind of men are the kind of men who creep into households. Some versions may say who creep into houses or creep into homes. Yes, they come into people's homes. Now, in the first century, remember, there weren't a lot of places to worship, and oftentimes people met in their homes. And even those itinerant preachers, those who would be traveling around and evangelizing and preaching from city to city, would oftentimes stay with someone in the community. They would stay there and they would preach the gospel, and then they would move on and stay with someone else. Well, these false teachers are those of this sort. That is, those people of this sort are those who creep into households. Note the present tense. They were already present. They were already doing this. They were already leading people astray. They were already corrupting the souls of people with their false doctrine, with their error they were teaching. For of this sort are those who creep into households. I believe the New International Version says they worm their way in. That is, they're very devious. They're very subtle. That is, they put up a false pretense of entering into your home. Really, the reason why they enter into your home is to lead you astray, lead you into error, corrupt your soul, bring about the condemnation of your soul. But of course, they would perhaps say, "No, I'm here to teach you the truth so you can be saved." Times haven't changed. For of this sort are those who creep into households. Note this. And they make captives of gullible women. They make captives of gullible women. Literally, the phrase gullible women here is little women. Little women. Silly women, the King James Version says. It's used here, of course, the word is used here, of course, to show a lack of respect for those who are under consideration. Now, he's not speaking about all women. He's not referring in a contemptuous way and referring to all women as little women or silly women or gullible women. Some versions translate it gullible, silly, weak-willed women. So he's not talking about all women, he's talking about some women. And just as there are women who could be characterized by this, there are men who can be characterized in the same way as well. But in the immediate context, he's speaking of women. Because evidently there are some in Ephesus, where Timothy is, who have this problem. That is, they're silly women. They're little women. They're weak-willed women. That is, the word describes foolish, immature women. Not young, necessarily, but adult women who are simply foolish and frivolous. One who displays immaturity and a lack of dignity. And that's who's under consideration. They're easily swayed by the expositors who would come their way. Of this sort are those who creep into households, note this, and they make captives of gullible women. Make captive. The ideal of making captive, of course, is not to be taken literally. They don't capture them as if they're holding them in captivity. But they lead them in captivity by their false doctrine, by their false teaching. That is, they make them subject to it. So that's how they capture these women who are immature in their thinking, who are frivolous, who are silly weak will, easily swayed away from the truth. And these women are also characterized as those who are loaded down with sins, loaded down with, heaped up with, burdened with, laden with. The idea is that they're overwhelmed in conscience, overwhelmed with the consciousness of sin. And so that evidently they're burdened with a sinful past. And people like that are always seeking some way to feel better about themselves. Their conscience is always bearing upon them because of their sinful condition, their sinful past. And they will, you might say, grasp at every straw that comes along to make them feel better about themselves. And is that not what a lot of religious teaching does today? It makes people feel better about themselves. Leaves them in their sin, but it makes them feel better about themselves. No, the lifestyle you're engaged in is not sinful. It's just an alternate lifestyle. There's nothing wrong with it. No reason for you to feel guilty about it. That's the way these false teachers evidently were treating these women, and that are classified as gullible or weak will, easily swayed, frivolous or foolish, loaded down with sin, burdened with the consciousness of sin, led away by various lusts, led away by various lusts, literally being led away, used metaphorically here. That is, they're induced or swayed or controlled or influenced by all sorts of impulses and inclinations of the flesh. In 1 Timothy, if you remember, Paul warned the young widows about a life that would be unpleasing to God. And he recommended that they find a new husband and marry if their first husband had died. Perhaps these false teachers, as they moved from place to place, would seek out women whom they could easily sway into error. You know, it's always been, and it has been the practice of some, if even in political matters, if you want to change or you might say implement some new political idea, then you first sway some women to be on your side. And what will they do? Because of the influence they have on their husbands, then they will sway their husbands to that idea as well. And pretty soon we have a new law being enacted because of that. And so these false teachers, they were simply using something that perhaps has always been used. And as I said, this is not a condemnation of women in general. There are such men who are foolish and frivolous and silly and weak-willed and easily swayed, but not so much as these women were in Ephesus, evidently. Another characteristic of these women is, he says, they're always learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Always learning. Always learning simply means they're always increasing their knowledge. Learning is the acquisition of knowledge. But they're always learning. And this pictures so well to me, so many in the denominational realm. They're always learning. Many of them are very zealous and they're eager to learn. They go to the Bible classes, they attend home studies, and they're very eager and zealous in learning and acquiring knowledge. But guess what? They're always learning, but they're never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. They're never able to acknowledge the truth. Because as long as one is fed error, as long as one feeds himself on that which is false, they will never be able to acknowledge the truth. They'll never be able to come to an understanding of the truth. And so as long as man takes the doctrines of men and learns from the doctrines of men as long as that's all they consume, they'll never acknowledge the truth. They'll never come to an understanding of the truth. And so always learning, but never able to come to a knowledge of it. Note that, never able. It's not that they don't have the intellectual ability to come to a knowledge of the truth. They have the intellectual ability to come to a knowledge of the truth. But because they're not able, because they're being fed error. They're being taught that which is false. And as long as they're taught that which is false, they will never learn the truth. Now as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Now, as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, these two individuals that are mentioned here, not mentioned in the Old Testament scriptures, but they're believed to be the magicians that Pharaoh used to oppose Moses, to resist Moses. You can go back and look at this in Exodus 7, in verse 11 and following, as well as in chapter 8 of Exodus, in verse 7. They used sorcery to oppose or resist Moses. Remember, Moses would throw down his rod and he could take it back up. Moses could throw down his rod, it'd turn into a serpent. They throw down their rod, it'd turn into a serpent. They resisted Moses. They opposed Moses. Now get this in verse 8, 2 Timothy 3. Now as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, as they opposed Moses, so do these also resist the truth. They resist the truth. They oppose the truth. They stand against the truth. The truth under consideration is the gospel. Who's under consideration? Well, these men, these false teachers, chapter 3 and verse 1, know this, that in last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves. He describes these false teachers that creep into houses, go in by stealth, subtlety, and deceive people with false doctrine. As a matter of fact, remember in 1 Timothy, some had gone into homes and destroyed whole households, made great shipwreck of the faith of many. And so, just as Jannes and Jambres stood against Moses, so do these also resist the truth. These men, these false teachers resist, stand opposed to the truth. The truth under consideration, no doubt, is the gospel. Then he describes them as men of corrupt minds. Men of corrupt minds. Corrupt minds? Minds that have been corrupted. Minds that are depraved, some versions say. Minds that have been morally ruined. Minds that have become perverse. Now, how did their minds become perverse? How did their minds become corrupted? Through the false doctrine they were feeding themselves or had been fed. That's how it became corrupted. Corrupted means ruined, morally ruined, perverse, depraved. Their minds had become that way because of what they had fed themselves with. Error, false teaching. And so the minds of these gullible women would have become corrupted as well through the false doctrine, through the error that they were being taught. So these false teachers are men of corrupt minds. Note this, disapprove, the King James Version says, reprobate concerning the faith. Disapproved. Literally, the idea in the word reprobate or disapproved is not standing the test. Not standing the test. It was a word that the Greeks used in reference to the testing of metals. And so when metal would be put through the furnace, it would either be proven to be genuine, That is, it would pass the test. When it's melted down, of course, remember the dross would separate from it. That which was not part of the pure metal would separate from it. And so you would see that which is genuine. So if metal was put through the furnace and it was melted down, it was proved to be genuine. It would prove to pass the test or fail the test, be disapproved. And that's the word used here. Disapproved, reprobate. They failed to pass the test. Paul used this word over in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 and in verse 28 in regard to the Gentiles. In Romans 1 and verse 28, Romans 1 and verse 28, he said, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them up to," here's the word, "to a debased man, to do those things which are not fitting." A debased man, a reprobate man, a man that was disapproved by God, a man that was rejected by God. So these individuals under consideration are disapproved. They're disapproved. They're reprobate. They're rejected, note this, concerning the faith, concerning the gospel. So we have a gospel mentioned in this verse twice, by both the phrase, the truth, and then the faith. The faith condemns such men. The truth, the gospel, condemns such men. So these men who resist, who oppose, who stands against the truth, men who have corrupt minds, are disapproved, or reprobate or rejected concerning the faith, the gospel. Chapter 3 and in verse 9, "But they," who are the they under consideration? Well, the false teachers, the one who creeps, who goes in subtly or by stealth in the households and leads women captive by the error, by their false teachings. "But they will progress no further." They will progress no further, used figuratively here, meaning to proceed no further, to progress, to increase. Could be translated that they will not accomplish much. They'll not get very far. They'll not make much progress. Well, why? Well, he gives the reason why. For their folly will be manifest to all. The word "for" there, Greek conjunction, gives a reason, gar, for the previous statement. So they, that is the false teacher, will progress no further. They'll not get very far. They'll not accomplish much. They'll not make much progress. Why? Because their folly, their madness, their lack of understanding, their lack of common sense, their senselessness, their foolishness, will be manifest. It'll be evident. It'll be quite plain. It'll be very conspicuous to everyone. Now, when will that happen? Doesn't seem like it's happening now, or perhaps didn't happen back then while they were teaching that era and people were following after them. But it certainly will be conspicuous. It will be quite plain and very evident and clear come the day of judgment that they won't get very far. Their folly, their foolishness, and their senselessness will end in this life, as theirs also was. As theirs also was, last portion of verse 9, who's under consideration? Jannes or Jannes and Jambres. As Jannes and Jambres' foolishness, senselessness, was quite evident, so also will these individuals be. Now, when was it that Jannes and Jambres' senselessness and foolishness became evident? Well, when Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of bondage, out of Egyptian bondage. It wasn't long before those magicians could not match the power of the miracles that Moses was able to perform by the power of God. And so, of course, they were released from Egyptian captivity. And the magicians were simply shown to be foolish, senseless. They were devoid of understanding. Verse 10. But you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecutions, and afflictions, which happened to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. What persecutions I endured, and out of them all the Lord delivered me. Well, it seems as though the subject has changed again, but it hasn't really. You might say it's changed back to what he was speaking about before, and that is that of endurance. This is at least the third or fourth time in the book that he's mentioned endurance or perseverance, and he mentions it again here. Just back in the second chapter, remember, in second chapter, in verse 4, no one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life that he may please him who enlisted him as, or verse 3 I should have. You therefore must endure, there's our word, hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. So endurance, he brings up the point of endurance again, perseverance. After having mentioned these false teachers, he comes back to some very personal remarks to Timothy himself. But you have carefully followed. But you have, that is, Timothy, is put in contrast to these false teachers who really don't care what matters. And so Timothy has some experience and knowledge that these false teachers evidently do not have. Timothy has carefully followed. That is, he's followed very closely the life of the Apostle Paul. It's used metaphorically here to means that he has devoted himself to Paul as an example. That is, Paul has become his example. He conforms himself to Paul as an example. But you have carefully followed, he says, my doctrine. That is, you've carefully followed the things that I've taught. The word doctrine here sometimes is translated teaching, sometimes it's translated doctrine. The word can be used in two different ways. Some kind of refer to the act of teaching itself. Sometimes it refers to that which is taught. And that's what's under consideration here. You followed my doctrine. That is, you followed my gospel message. You followed the divine teaching that I presented. You followed my instruction. Yes, that's what he did. He devoted himself to the example that Paul had set. So he was imitating Paul. So you followed my doctrine. You followed the gospel that I've been teaching. You've devoted yourselves to it. You've given yourself up to it. You know the divine teaching that I presented, the instruction that I have taught. Not only that, he said as well in verse 10, but you have followed carefully my doctrine. And though it is not mentioned in the English translation, my is before every one of these phrases. My doctrine, my manner of life, my purpose, my faith, my long suffering. So you followed my doctrine, you followed my manner of life. That is, you followed my conduct and behavior, my way of life, my course of life. Thus, the life that he led. That is, he had used Paul's life as an example. As an example to pattern his life after. Paul's conduct and Paul's behavior had become his behavior and his conduct. Now, isn't that scary? Would you want somebody to do that with your life? Would you want somebody to carefully follow? So scary indeed if someone would imitate our life, and it's not the kind of life that God would have us to lead. But Paul was leading a righteous life, and so Timothy considered that conduct and behavior and patterned himself after it. You've carefully followed not only my doctrine, my manner of life, but also my purpose, that is my intent, my aim, my resolve, the chief aim in my life. And it is usually that which is planned or purposed in advance. Someone plans or purpose in advance to say, well, this is my aim. This is my purpose in life. And what was that Paul's aim or purpose in life? Well, to live a righteous life and to go to heaven one day. Well, Timothy had followed that. He had carefully followed that. He had devoted himself to Paul's purpose in life, his chief aim in life. And then he says, you have carefully followed my faith. That is, you patterned yourself after the trust and confidence and conviction that I've had in God and in the Lord Jesus Christ. You've carefully followed that. You've carefully followed my long-suffering. Long-suffering here, translated patience in some versions. I think it's translated patience in the King James, I believe. But the word itself, long-suffering, has reference to one who has the power or the ability to avenge himself of wrongs, but does not. Like God is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. He's long-suffering toward us. That is, he puts up with our sin. That is, he puts up with our standing against him from time to time, opposing him from time to time by our life and by our conduct. He puts up with that. He bears long with it. He is long-suffering. He could avenge, but he does not. And so Paul was long-suffering. That is, he suffered long with people. He put up with the perversity. He put up with a... Now, I'm not saying he tolerated it. He spoke against it. He condemned it. He did all he could to change people's behavior and conduct. But when you're a Christian seeking to live a godly life, there's some things you must suffer long with. There's some things you must be long-suffering with. Sometimes you have to be long-suffering with people who do not live up to the standard of God's Word nearly enough in their life. They claim to be Christians, but they're only Christians to a certain degree. And what do? We bear long with them. We're patient with them, hoping that they'll mature spiritually. Hoping that they'll grow in the faith. Hoping that they'll get their lives under control. Sometimes we have to be long-suffering to people who call us bad names and who slander us and defame us. Paul was long-suffering. He bore long with a lot of people that stood opposed against him. Then he says, but you've also carefully followed my love. The word translated love here is the highest form of love. The Greeks knew, agape. That is the kind of love that God has for man. Agape love is God seeking man's greatest good. God seeking man's greatest and highest good. That's love. And so if God seeks our greatest and highest good, our love for man will do the same thing. We will seek the highest and greatest good for every man in this world. And so, that's the kind of love that Paul had, and Timothy had carefully followed it. Not only that, he says, but you have carefully followed my perseverance. Now, here's where the King James Version uses the word patience instead of long-suffering. King James Version used the word patience here instead of perseverance, but patience is not a good translation. The word perseverance is better, or the word endurance. Endurance, perseverance, steadfastness. It's a firmness of spirit and mind of one, unwilling to yield even in the face of hardship and even in the face of danger. One perseveres. One endures. You know, the modern-day vernacular for that, I guess, would be one has grit. Regardless of the hardship and difficulty of the task, they keep pressing forward. Paul had perseverance. He had endurance. Remember, he's going to tell us in chapter 4 that he finished the race. He didn't give up. He didn't quit. He didn't drop out. He finished it. He endured. He persevered. All the hardship, all the persecution that came his way, he persevered. He endured through it. And so he mentions perseverance in the very persecutions in the very next verse, in verse 11. Persecutions and afflictions, which happened to me at Antioch. Persecutions. The word persecutions itself carries the word of pursuit initially. Pursuit. But it's the idea of pursuing one with the intent of causing them harm. Like Paul persecuted Christians. You know, when he went in Acts chapter 9 to the religious leaders of his day and ask for letters or ask for permission, ask for authority to go as far away as Damascus to bring Christians back to the city of Jerusalem in chains, he persecuted Christians. That is, he pursued them. He harassed them. He pursued them with the intent of causing injury or harm to them. That's the idea in the word persecution here. It consistently is used in the New Testament in reference to religious persecution. You know, some people are persecuted, but they're not persecuted the way the New Testament speaks about persecution. The word is always consistently used in reference to religious persecution. Some people even today are crying out because they're being persecuted. Being persecuted, and there are a lot of them using, quoting scripture. Taking it out of the context from which it is used. Religious persecution is that which the word has reference to. And so he had carefully followed Paul's persecutions. Paul had been harassed. Great injury and harm had come to him, and that's associated with the word afflictions here. Difficulty and grief and trouble and distress and calamity and suffering had come upon Paul. Timothy had carefully followed it. He was fully aware of it. He was fully aware of what had happened at Antioch. This is Antioch of Pisidia, not Antioch of Syria. You can read about this in Acts 13 and verse 50, where Paul was expelled from that region by the unbelieving Jews. Then he mentioned, and this was all three of these that are mentioned here, is on his first evangelistic journey. Then he mentions the persecutions and afflictions that happened to him at Iconium. At Iconium, the unbelieving Jews, in connection with the Gentiles, plotted against Paul and planned to stone him. And so he had to flee from that region. And then in Lystra, what happened? Well, he was stoned and drug outside the city and left for dead. Timothy's hometown, evidently, Acts 16 and verse 1. Timothy was fully aware of this. He knew all of this. We're out of time. We'll have to stop. We'll pick up with that phrase next week. What persecutions I endured. What persecutions I persevered. I did it, Timothy. You can do it too. And out of them all, the Lord delivered me. The Lord rescued me. We'll pick up with that statement next Lord's Day morning. Thank you very much for your kind attention.